Joint Committee on Tax Credits will come to order. Colleagues, we are going to go ahead and get started with our informational meeting, and we will return back to the business of the committee as we have sufficient members to do so. So I would like to open an informational meeting on the Business Energy Tax Credit Rate of Return Study. Thank you, Director Repine, for joining us, and why don't you go ahead and kick it off for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I am Director Bob Repine for the Department of Energy. I'm happy to be with you today. This presentation is about House Bill 2180 from the session prior. I had made sure that each one of you received a copy of that bill because as I reply on this piece of legislation to my staff, I say, well, it's one of those bills that always fit into the category of short bill should pass. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of words there, but it was a very important piece of legislation that was taken up in the prior session to talk about asking questions about the programs that we have at the Department of Energy, particularly the BETSI program, and how it affects programs that use those resources to advance the industries and advance economic opportunities for the state of Oregon. And so what we, as you know, the agency in 2009 was given this charge. In 2010, as we were getting ready to go out for the find a contractor for this, we moved into the February session of 2010 where a lot of modifications were made to the BETSI programs, particularly around the renewables. If you remember, this piece of legislation, as it states, deals with wind energy and conservation projects. And the end result of what you did in the February 10 session on 3680 was changed greatly the criteria around particularly large wind and the whole structure about the around the BETSI program. We put a cap in place. We didn't have a cap before. Created tier programs for competitive purposes. We asked for outputs and measurements to determine that we're getting the best investment for those programs that we're funding. So we, after that session, it came to my attention to continue with this report that some of the criteria had changed as it pertained particularly to the wind industry. And so I asked many of you, I contacted many of you that are on the dais today and some other of your colleagues about with the changes that came about from 3680, how might we go about this report in a way that still adds value to what the spirit of 2180 was directing us to do, but in light of the changes that took place. Then we went ahead and made a determination with that input that we wanted to kind of expand the study a little bit more. So if you notice, the study is a little greater than just the wind and conservation facilities. It also takes on other renewables, particularly solar and biomass. So these were expansions of this program as directed from 2180. We went out and looked for a contractor. We had a couple of failed attempts at it. We reported that back to you through some communications to the chairs of this interim committee. And subsequently, an award was made to IEC, who's here with me today, to make the presentation. Some of you, during the same summer interim of 2010, had an opportunity to meet with the contractors, to sit down either with them face-to-face or be on a phone call with them to go through some of the criteria that we would be using to, as we advance this study that was going to be undertaken with the legislature, for the legislature. So with that conversation and the direction from the bill itself, the contractor went out and started their work. We also wanted to share with you the fact that we created a peer review group for this study. We felt it was important that we had other economists, people who understood this industry and the elements of a report such as this, that they would be involved in a review of the activities of this report as advanced. And so your own staff member, Chris Allenack, was a member, and also in the audience, Tom Podowski was a member of the peer review group as well. We also wanted to make sure that the agency had a role to play, but not a prescriptive role as in the outcome of this report. So we've played a role as a facilitator. We found the contractor. We worked with them to find out what they wanted their samples to be like. We advanced the information that we could advance to them on each of the projects. They chose the projects that they used in their samplings. We offered them any other information necessary to complete the task they needed to. So we played a more of a second role to them, so we kept our hands clean in the results of this report. So, again, I just wanted to share this as a background to the presentation that John will be making here shortly. But we're happy to be here in front of you, and I think you'll find the results of the report of interest to you and to the state of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Colleagues, let's go ahead and dive into this report. And if we could just, unless there are things that didn't make sense in the report, if we could hold questions to the end, that would be fantastic. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Weiss. I am a senior associate with Industrial Economics Incorporated. We are a consulting services firm located in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I'm happy to be here, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about this report. Obviously, there's a lot of information in the report. I'm hopeful that I can get through a presentation relatively quickly so that there's plenty of time for questions. I'm sure you have some, and I look forward to answering those. I will tell you that I worked with a great team of people that really dug into a lot of the details. And while I can answer, I think, many of your questions, there may be some very specific items you're interested in that I may have to defer and get back to you on if I want to consult with my colleagues who are not here today. So, as Director Repine mentioned, the scope really revolves around the primary question of House Bill 2180, which is to examine the extent to which renewable energy and conservation projects depend on the business energy tax credit. Put in slightly simpler terms, would some projects have gone forward anyway? As the director described, the scope was expanded not only to include additional categories of projects beyond wind energy and conservation, but also to look at the question of economic impact, which is a challenging subject matter, but one, of course, that has great interest to many people, especially these days. And so we undertook to examine the economic impacts of BEPSI recipient projects. And this is, I want to just be clear that this is independent of the question of the so-called but-for question of, you know, did a project depend on the BEPSI? Initially, we're only focused on the impacts of any project that did receive a tax credit. But having done the financial analysis, the question of how important was the BEPSI to a project, it led us naturally to a third question, which is how much of that economic impact that we can measure do we think we can actually attribute to the tax credit? If projects would have happened anyway, then the economic impacts would have been realized anyway as well. The period of analysis, as mentioned, is 2002 to 2009. Actually, I apologize. I did want to make one other point, which is highlighted in our report. In addition to the questions we do answer, it's important to understand the questions we did not answer. There are three in particular. As I'll describe, we built our analysis off of projects that we believe are representative. We were very intentional in trying not to identify what those projects were. Certainly, there are details of each of these projects we looked at that we didn't have. We were dependent on the applicant files, by and large, and the information that was contained therein. It was not our intent to single out any one project as not deserving of a tax credit or didn't need a tax credit. We weren't trying to do that by any stretch of the imagination, nor were we trying to do that in a global sense in saying, well, X percent of all the projects that received a tax credit really didn't need it. That was not our intent at all. Second is the fact that this is not an attempt to estimate the number of jobs that were created by the program. I do know there's a lot of interest in that. As part of our economic impact analysis, we do address employment-related effects, but I want to be clear, and I'm sure I'll repeat this at least one more time, that it is not an estimate of job creation. That is a different kind of analysis beyond the scope of what we were asked to do and what we were able to do with the information that we had. So I'll leave that out there. And third, just a, kind of a general point, there may be interest in the question of what's the state's return on its investment. The state puts the money in through a tax credit program. It gets something back. There's likely a way that you could come up with a single number that suggests that you got a return of X percent on your investment. Again, a very interesting question, but one that is beyond the scope of our study. So moving on to this slide. We did look at the period 2002 to 2009. Obviously, it made a lot of sense. It was a period of tremendous growth in the program for a variety of reasons. Renewable portfolio standard, increase in the tax credit from 35 to 50% for some projects, the growth of the pass-through program, the creation and the growth of the pass-through program. It is important to keep in mind that this is a retrospective analysis. Certain things have happened since 2009, since the end of the period we're looking at, that have had material effects on the program. We were simply asked to look back over this period of 10 years to see what we could learn about how well the program accomplished its objective. And I've got a couple slides. There's actually more slides here than I'm going to take the time to go through, but two in particular that are just useful as context for those who are maybe less familiar with the program. This is the distribution of all projects. They're categorized. ODO has 12 general categories to define the different types of projects that receive a tax credit. And this is the distribution of projects by type, just in terms of the numbers of projects that receive a tax credit. And what this slide shows, obviously, is very clear. The vast majority were conservation-related projects. And other categories comprise a much smaller number of tax credit recipient projects. You compare that to the distribution of the tax credits themselves in dollar terms. These are all 2010 inflated to 2010 dollars to account for the differences in years, and you obviously see a very different distribution. Conservation projects tend to be smaller and get smaller tax credits. Wind projects, many of them tend to be much larger and get larger tax credits, and everything in between. So this actually helped to inform our study, but it also points out some of the limitations in the fact that what we're looking at, the sectors that we looked at, what I tabulated account just over 50% of all the tax credit dollars that were granted during this period. But they are obviously categories of great interest. So I'm going to, if you allow me, I'm going to skip over a few slides here, some additional background, kind of general landscape, if you will, of the program. And we can come back to them if there are specific questions related to things like the pass-through. I did want to talk a bit about the way we selected projects, because I know that there are questions about, with so many projects and such a big question, how can you draw conclusions based on what was a relatively limited sample? And that is a very valid question. So I want to just take a couple minutes to walk through how we did this. We didn't actually start with the list, but based on the information we received from the department, a little over 13,000 tax credits were finalized during this period, 2002 to 2009. What we received from the department was a database of just over 11,000 projects across all 12 of the categories that you saw on the on the pie chart. We then, these are the areas that we focused on. And shows the number of projects that were within that database, within each category. There are four general categories: wind, conservation, solar, and biomass. We did a little bit of refinement and focused on two subcategories in the biomass category, focusing on what we called biomass combustion, which is basically if you're burning wood products or burning something to produce energy, and separately looked at biofuels production projects. Separate from biofuels infrastructure, these are just biofuel production, ethanol, biodiesel. Solar, by and large, are photovoltaic or PV projects, so we focus just on those. There are some solar thermal projects within the BEPSI world. And conservation, we initially focused on the two biggest categories by far, which were weatherization projects and lighting modification projects. As we went further, we ended up, you'll see in the report, we included two additional categories: HVAC, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning projects, and variable frequency drive, or VFD, projects. We included those because they are generally categorized as, you might call them, kind of high returns, significant energy savings relative to the size of the project in dollar terms. The reason it doesn't show up on here is because we didn't actually look at applicant files for those last two categories. We did a more of a general analysis based solely on the information that was contained in the database provided to us, which basically meant building our analysis from project cost data and information on payback periods that were reported in the database. So I want to go through each one of these and explain how we arrived at the projects that we did look at, starting with wind energy. Most of the projects in the database are multi-turbine projects, ranging in size from tens of megawatts to over 100 megawatt projects. obviously in this industry they're getting bigger and bigger. There were several that were much smaller, down to the micro scale, you know, individual turbines in the kilowatt capacity range. So for each of these categories, we went through a two-step process. One was to identify the applicant files we wanted to actually review, and then from those, which ones we would select to do our detailed analyses. We asked for, this is a relatively small number of projects in total, so we asked for all the files for the larger wind energy projects. And of the smaller ones, of which there were four, we asked for two of those files. And we selected them randomly. We did not, we had no prior knowledge of what they were, but we figured within those general categories, there wouldn't be such variation that to select two of those four would cause us any real problem. We then, really driven mostly by resource and time constraints, we had to decide how many of these we can look at. We ultimately examined four of the larger projects in detail. And here we were careful to try to capture the full range of project sizes. Everything on the multi-turbine side, capturing everything from what's considered community scale wind all the way up to the largest utility scale. So we had something close to 10 megawatts, something in the 24, I think, and then one that was about 75 megawatts, and then a fourth one that was over 100. And we kept one of the micro scale, the kind of kilowatt scale projects as well. So we feel like we had a good representation of the spectrum of wind energy projects. For the two biomass categories, again, a relatively small number in total, so we simply said, please give us all the files. We'll take a look at all of them. We selected two of each to do a detailed analysis. I'll come back to this in a bit, but biomass is tricky because projects tend not to be as uniform across project types across projects as you might see in other categories, such as solar or wind. So we were driven, again, mostly by resource and time constraints and said, well, if we pick two within this category, they should be generally representative of what's going on in that sector, recognizing that there are going to be variations from project to project that we may not be able to capture. For solar, it's a larger number of projects in the database, so we wanted to sort them a little bit more carefully. And we created eight bins, if you will, defined by three different characteristics: location, kind of western part of the state, more urban, versus eastern part of the state. Size, we set a dividing line of 21 kilowatts, which was essentially the median of all the projects in the database, and then pre and post 2007 when the rules changed. And from each of these eight bins, we selected two projects at random to get to receive the project files for review, and then ultimately selected three of those for detailed analysis. And I can go through the last two relatively quickly. We did a similar exercise where we had just one screening criterion, which was energy saved, and we divided this into quartiles based on the reported amount of energy saved by each project. We selected two projects from each of those four categories to review the files, and then finally did detailed analyses of two of them, and the same exercise for lighting modification. So that's how we arrived at the number of projects that we did detailed analyses of. It is still a limited sample, but in the way that we went through the process of screening, categorizing and screening them and selecting them and trying not to really cherry-pick anything, we feel that even with a limited number, we have a representative sample, recognizing still that there's variation within the category, but they are still representative of the types of projects that exist within these different categories. So turn out to the financial analysis itself and talk a bit about our methodology. We needed a consistent way to examine projects across all categories, and decided that the best way to do that would be to focus on a measure known as the internal rate of return, or IRR, a common measure of financial performance that's a typical project developer a number that someone would look at to see, is the return on this investment going to be worth the investment that I'm going to make? And we built our analysis for each project. We built the analysis up from the bottom. We did a pro forma, kind of a spreadsheet model, cash flow analysis that recreated as best we could what we think the kind of examination that a project developer would go through in making this determination as to whether a project was financially viable. So we were able to develop IRR estimates based on the information available to us in the applicant files. And the key is we needed to compare it to something. We wanted to compare it to what's referred to as a hurdle rate. So an investor says, I want to make 10% on my investment, and we could look at the IRR and say, did it meet that test? We didn't want to be so precise. We defined, as the report explains, we defined a range for each category that is based on the literature. There's sufficient information available that says, in fairly recent literature, that describes what a typical investor in a certain type of project would expect to get as a return. And what we were looking for was whether or not the Betsy pushed the IRR. If it was below that target range, did it push it into the target range? Or if it was in the target range, did it push it above the target range? And in the simplest sense, the significance of the Betsy was considered larger if a project that looked like it had an IRR below the target range moved into the IRR range once we added the tax credit in. So that's the... Hopefully it was clear what our basic approach was answering the fundamental question that the legislature posed. And as the report goes, you'll see there's a lot of these colorful tables in the report. We felt it was important to include sensitivity analyses because there are certain factors that are pretty important in determining IRR, namely for these types of projects, the cost, the value of the energy that's either produced or saved, and the kind of unit capital cost to build them or to install a new lights. And so we wanted to see how sensitive the results were to those kinds of variables. And the charts allowed us to do that and really kind of backed up the initial analysis of comparing the performance of the project with and without the tax credit. So I've tried to boil the entire financial analysis down to a four-bullet slide. There's obviously a lot more detail than I can cover here or would even attempt to cover in a short presentation. But I'd like to just highlight our key findings. The number one was one that was not a great surprise to us, but we were pleased to be able to confirm, essentially our initial premise, which is that, and I hate to say it this way, but the answer is it depends. The tax credit does make a difference in many, many cases, and for certain types of projects more than others, but it varies. It does vary by project type. It varies by project scale. So even within a category, there may be projects that are more dependent or for which the tax credit is more important than others simply because of how big the project is. And it does change over time as well. And this is, I think, maybe most apparent in an industry like the wind energy industry, which has been maturing rapidly. And projects that received a tax credit in the early part of the 2000s probably had experienced a different level of dependence or significance of the Betsy compared to projects that were built toward the end of the decade. We did try to go a step further and try to get a sense of are there any general relationships that we could identify that would help, I don't want to call them rules of thumb, but things that would help to better understand whether a project is more or less likely to be dependent on the tax credit. And the two in the second bullet that we noted, they're not, I wouldn't say the most earth-shattering conclusions, but they're still interesting. When the value of the tax credit is large relative to the project cost, it tends to have a greater significance to the project. And given the way we set up our analysis, obviously the larger the initial gap is between the IRR without the tax credit and the target, the greater the chances that it makes a difference. If you've got a long way to go and it can push it a bit, you know, quite a bit toward that target range, then by definition it was more significant. If it started in the target range and it moved it up, it could still make a difference, but we'd say it makes less of a difference. So we try to, and I want to be careful in explaining this, the third bullet, we try to array the different categories on a spectrum of impact, if you will. And at one end, it appears that solar projects and the smaller scale wind projects experienced a greater, the tax credit had a greater impact on making them financially viable projects. At the other end of the spectrum are the larger scale wind projects, with conservation falling somewhere in between. This is not to say that the tax credit is not needed by a large-scale wind project in all cases. As I mentioned, it can vary a bit from project to project. What we're trying to convey is simply that in relative terms, it appears to have more of an impact on certain kinds of projects than on others. Clearly, there are certain projects that would happen anyway. If the tax credit weren't there, they'd likely be built for many reasons. I mean, there's a lot of other factors beyond tax credits that are driven by factors well beyond the borders of Oregon, frankly, that are gonna influence developers and where and when and what they might want to build, or what projects they might want to undertake. So this is very much a relative scale. And I want to make sure that is clear. Coming back just briefly to this biomass question, we did not include it on this spectrum only because it kind of falls, you know, the biofuels projects we looked slightly less dependent on the tax credit than the biomass combustion projects. But again, because they have the biomass projects are subject to commodity markets, certainly on the biofuel side, both for their inputs and their output, and those can be highly uncertain and can entail quite a bit of risk. And so for a lot of those kinds of projects, the developers are trying to manage that risk as best they can, and the tax credit can help to do that, but there may be much bigger issues at play than simply whether the tax credit's there. So the projects we looked at, I think on the combustion side, they look like the tax credit did make a difference, but it's hard to pin that one down. I want to spend just a couple minutes on the economic impact methodology and results, not because they're not interesting. It was secondary part of our analysis, so I don't want to spend too much time on it. IMPLAN is a model that is very commonly used to measure economic impact. We supplemented it with another model that was developed specifically for examination of wind energy projects. It is very much a screening level analysis. It is intended to provide a sense of, A, are there economic impacts? The answer is yes. And, B, what is the general scale of those impacts? And in our report, we show the range of those, what we believe the range of those impacts to be. We don't really want to go much beyond those ranges because it would take a much larger effort to get into a greater level of detail. But we do examine it in terms of three primary metrics: employment demand, labor income, which is a direct offshoot of employment demand, and what I refer to as net dollars into the economy. It's really kind of a value added or similar to a kind of a gross state product kind of measure. We looked at this at the individual project level, and for larger categories like solar and conservation, we tried to aggregate as best we could to determine what is the overall impact of these projects, and we examined these impacts in two phases: installation costs versus the ongoing operation costs. And there's a lot of information on this slide. I won't try to go through it all, but if you look to the columns at the right, you can see what we believe the estimated impacts are by category for all projects, as well as the ones that we consider to be Betsy dependent. The Betsy dependency was driven by results of the financial analysis, and then tried to get a sense of the economic impacts relative to the scale of the tax credit investment. And you can see that in most cases it is positive. There is a positive impact. There is variation. Obviously, projects that are less dependent on the Betsy are going to have economic impacts that are less attributable to the tax credit. It's fairly straightforward. But and I'm happy to answer more questions about the economic impact later. But I'll try to wrap up. I did want to note, just reiterate the fact that even though our projects are not any kind, in any sense a statistically significant sample of the universe of projects, we believe that our we therefore arrived at conclusions which are somewhat general, but we do acknowledge the limitations of the sample size. Because we are focused on an IRR measure, it's very sensitive to what numbers we selected. We use the best information available from the literature, but certainly there could be differences of opinion on what the correct IRR is. And frankly, that IRR can vary from person to person. And the economic impacts obviously are a snapshot of the universe of benefits that a project can deliver. It goes beyond simply employment impacts. There are larger societal impacts and benefits that can accrue to these projects. We did offer a few recommendations based on our study, and I think they followed pretty naturally. One is simply to recognize the differences in the impact of the tax credit across project types and to strive to tailor the criteria, eligibility criteria, accordingly. We think it's crucial that the program be allowed to adapt to the way the market changes. These are dynamic markets. You've seen how the wind energy industry has evolved in just the past 10 years. Other industries could be expected to follow suit, and it's important not for for a tax credit program to be static and to continue to move with the market so that the state's money is invested in the best way possible. And in order to do that, we think it's important for there to be more information. The applicant files were very useful, but it would have been more useful to have additional information on sources of funding and their debt structure, and certainly to get a sense of how the program is performing, to know, especially for something like a conservation project, how much energy did it save, rather than simply what was the anticipated savings. And finally, we identified at least three questions that we think would be interesting for further inquiry. One does focus on the pass-through. It does appear that there's a very, very, it appears to be very useful, particularly in the public sector, as a way of leveraging money for a school system, for example, that might have capital constraints, and for whom an IRR may not even be the most important measure. But there's a lot more, I think, digging that could be done there. This question of scale we think is interesting. We talked about wind energy and how as you get bigger, it appears to have less of an impact. We're not sure where that, if there is a dividing line, where that might be. And we think it would be interesting to see, not just for wind energy, but for other categories, if there's a way to better get a sense of how scale and dependence or importance, how they relate to each other. We also note that economic impact, we've made assumptions about where kind of materials are coming from to support some of these projects, and by and large, we assumed they were not being produced within the state, but certainly as the solar industry grows and other sectors grow, where more and more of the materials and needs can be provided in state, that's going to have a huge ripple effect on the economy. It would make a large difference. That's just one element of how the economic impact analysis could be expanded considerably to get into much more detail on what it truly means. I probably took more time than you wanted me to. I apologize for that, but hopefully that was a good overview of our study. It was an interesting study to undertake, lots of challenges, but we think some very interesting results and something that certainly we hope the legislature and the department can build on going forward.
Thank you very much. It's important to take questions from the committee. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for this analysis. I think it's likely to be quite helpful for us. I did note that in your analysis, you indicated certain characteristics of biomass projects make them harder to categorize, and then later on you indicated in your chart that the biomass combustion, biomass fuels economic impact were likely positive, whereas others you said were positive.
Mm-hmm.
Biofuels issues, things involving biofuels have also developed a kind of a controversy lately around the whole carbon cycle and whether they actually fit within the kind of long-term effort that we're trying to pursue. Can you give us any additional information than what you had in your quick summary about the analysis that you made and why you ended up with this very ambiguous kind of answer for us, and what the parameters are around that answer?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barnhart, it is a difficult question. I will admit that the biomass sector is the one we probably feel we know the least about. We pulled out a couple of projects that we thought were good representatives of what's going on there. As I mentioned, particularly in biofuels, you're right, there's lots of questions swirling around biomass in general in terms of what it, you know, what does it really mean in terms of carbon and other factors. And I would point back to particularly in the biofuels, and I think this relates to the combustion side as well, is that this question about feedstocks is one of the more important ones, because it's a critical part of the process. But you need to, on a combustion project, you need to have something to burn. For the biofuels, you need some sort of feedstock as your basis for creating. And there tend to be agricultural products, which are subject to their own markets and their own uncertainties. And I think that understanding the relationship between those markets, those agricultural markets, and the energy market is critical, but very challenging. And so the reason we ended up with a somewhat ambiguous response is because we didn't feel like we could, in the scope of this project, we could delve far enough into it to be that, to be more certain than that. Other than to say that it does appear, based on our limited sample, there does appear to be, on the economic impact side, a positive relationship, that it does generate positive economic activity relative to the scale of investment. Focusing on the financial side, again, it appears that the projects, it does help. It helps to varying degrees, mainly as a way to try to mitigate the risk that I referred to. But not by itself. It's hard to say that by itself, you know, absent the tax credit, the project will happen or the project won't happen. It's a more complicated industry, and I apologize for being somewhat wishy-washy about it. But if I were to add a fourth bullet on this slide, that would be it. It would be to say, you know, especially in a region like this where there is potentially tremendous resource, it would be good to know, you know, how much of a difference this tax credit makes, and what even as a separate question, what is the economic impact of these biomass products?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you. I will be brief. I sort of honed in on the same issue, which is you mentioned in solar PV, one of the things you noted was that we are growing that industry within the state. Well, I can tell you we're growing a lot of biomass within this state, too, and so that's why the importance of this biomass piece and its potential for economic activity is huge, and the ambiguous nature of your report gives us all I think the conclusion is we need more information.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this analysis. In looking at the wind utility, $87.3 million in the projects that you looked at, and your conclusion that it has a limited economic impact, my question is, based on the data that you have reviewed, if we were to make that decision today, the same decisions we made that set this in motion, were that before us today, should we make the same decisions to move forward and grant those tax credits for the large-scale wind?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Morse. I'd like to give you a definitive answer. And I don't want to simply say it depends. I think that our conclusion that the utility scale wind. Well, I want to make sure that I'm clear. I'm understanding that you're focused on the financial viability question more so than the economic impact. I heard you. I think you referred to both. I mean, the economic impact. There's no question that these projects have a potentially significant economic impact. Certainly during the construction phase, and to some extent as they continue to operate, the limited nature is simply in the context of Betsy dependence. So we think those impacts happen anyway, you know, even if some of these projects would likely have gone forward even without the tax credit. But I don't want to say that there is that in absolutely you get to a certain size wind project and tax credits have no bearing. I think it's important to I have to remind myself that you know we did this analysis we looked at it somewhat narrowly. We focused on this IRR measure and we looked at the applicant information. The information was in the applicant files, but we knew that there was a lot more information out there about individual projects that for any one project would likely shift the result for that particular project analysis one way or the other, which is why it's important for us not to think that the results of the limited number of analyses we do here are just automatically relevant or would be the same for another project. It looks more or less the same because it could have a very different set of circumstances. So I'm afraid I'm not exactly answering your question, but I think that it's hopefully the point that it's not that we're not trying to draw conclusions that can be applied to a project, but to explain the relative significance given certain categories of projects. We hope is a useful building block for the state going forward.
If I might absolutely follow up. I guess to phrase it a different way, the projects exceeded the hurdle rate in their internal rate of return, which therefore would lead you to a conclusion that they were not Betsy dependent. Is that I'm hearing?
Given our basic construct for our analysis, if we looked at and the way we set up these analyses was we kind of stacked incentives kind of one at a time to see how incrementally things change, and at the very end we added the Betsy to see, you know, where was it before we added the Betsy and what happened to it after. So given the way we constructed it, if all the incentives that we knew about that we included put the project into the target range already, we would say, we wouldn't say that the tax credit was not significant. We would say that it was less significant, that it appeared, if that target IRR range is accurate for that particular project, we would say that that project would have gone forward. If that's the return they were looking for, then it would have gone forward even before the tax credit were received.
And I apologize.
No, please.
But could you give us an idea of what kind of IRR these projects were achieving?
What they actually achieved?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We can only say what IRR we were able to calculate based on the information that we had, which is not to say that it is exactly what the IRR was. What would have been interesting, had we more time, we would have spent a lot more time talking to these folks directly and getting a lot more detailed information about their projects, because we could have refined the analyses and made sure that there wasn't some factor that was critical that really, and it would have been informative. It may have been an outlier. It may have been like some strange circumstance that no other project had ever seen, but it would have been able to allow us to provide a very clear snapshot of that type of project. We don't know. We don't, and that's why we tried very hard, once we had picked the projects, to forget about which projects they actually were, because we didn't want it to appear that we had determined what the return was for that particular project.
I understand that.
Yeah.
It's an inexact analysis, but I'm trying to get at what kind of IRR did you realize in your analysis?
Well, I would just refer to and I apologize, I don't remember the exact number, but the range that we used for wind was, I believe, 6 to, well, I should actually look it up so I don't guess here. 6.5 at the low end to 15 on the high end. And it's, you know, I should also note that we applied a single range across all project scales. That the range is, it's obviously going to be different for someone who's doing a smaller scale project than for someone doing a larger scale project. We didn't try to make that distinction, but our hope was that by reviewing as much of the kind of literature that's out there that talks about anticipated returns for wind energy projects, any project that we looked at, regardless of scale, would be captured by that range. So that we don't think that there are developers who are looking to realize returns below 6.5%, nor do we think that there are people who are interested in returns much higher than 15%. We think that is the appropriate general range for that type of project. And as you can see, it is relatively low compared to the other categories we looked at. And I think that is in part a reflection of the maturation of the wind energy industry. The more risky the project, the higher the return someone's likely to expect or require.
Representative Burr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to drill down a little bit on transportation, and I want to understand this, maybe what conclusion you would draw. Looking at your two charts, the two circle pie graphs, the distribution of projects by type, transportation is 18% of it, and then on the next pie chart, we look at distribution of tax credits by type, and transportation is 22%. Seems to me, and I want to make sure what conclusions you're drawing, it seems to me that transportation is very dependent. I mean, it's getting almost a one-to-one ratio of getting one, you know, it's getting its a good amount of the credits for the amount of projects out there. What conclusion would you draw, and then from the comparison of that, and then in which economic impact project category are transportation projects?
Unfortunately, this is a very easy question for me to answer because that was not within the scope of our analysis. We did not look at a single transportation project. It is a category. It's interesting because it does stand out as one of the larger categories that's not addressed. This was based on the direction we received. We did our study based on a very specific scope of work that defined the areas for us to examine, and transportation was not one of them. We had more than enough we could do to focus on the four general categories we did. So that might be the fifth bullet point on my final slide, which is what's going on with the transportation. I, to be honest, we barely looked at it, so I couldn't even tell you. I couldn't describe well what the actual project types are. I know there was a large number of similar types just from scanning the database, but we didn't look at a single applicant file related to transportation projects.
Bob?
Yeah, thank you. Just another follow-up. Looking at the projects and average credit by program year graph, can you tell me, you measure, well, actually looking at all of these graphs, I just want to clarify, the projects you analyzed, if I'm not mistaken, are actually from the population of projects that actually applied for the credit. What is your analysis in light of total projects done for projects that maybe didn't apply for the credit? Any of the Betsy credits from any of the categories? And what are your thoughts on that? And
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Brewer, that's a good question, because what we focused on, the database that we started with, were projects that had received final certification. So we didn't have information on, and I think if I'm understanding your question, information on projects that didn't reach that stage. And perhaps you're asking, you know, what might have influenced whether a project did reach the final certification stage and actually received the tax credit. I hate to say that things are beyond the scope of our study, but that is again something that was beyond the scope. We were limited to the projects within this initial database that received a tax credit during this particular period of time, and then just went on from there. So it's not an issue that we specifically were able to address.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last follow-up then. Might that change a little bit of the tone of the analysis in the fact that there may be projects done that aren't Betsy dependent that also did not apply for the credit, and perhaps the population of applicants that actually apply for the credit might inherently be more Betsy dependent because of it. So the actual conclusion may have a different tone because of projects that never applied.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Brewer, that is, it's a good point. I mentioned at the beginning that the way that we narrowed our focus down to these categories accounts for a large number of projects within the Betsy world within this period. But in terms of dollars, It does not. It's just over 50%. There are other categories out there where something was happening that we don't know about. And so it is possible that our conclusions could be a little bit different if we had looked at everything, if we had taken a sample of every project category. I go out a little bit on a limb and say that I'm guessing that the results wouldn't change dramatically. That we would see, and in part I say that because our results are somewhat general in nature. So to say that the tax credit has a different amount of impact or importance to different kinds of projects, that conclusion obviously would not change if we were to add in more project categories. It would likely just reinforce it. But having said that, there could be some very interesting stories that come out of an analysis of a category that we did not look at, where we could see either end of the spectrum, a dramatic dependence. Not a single project would have happened. I mean, this is obviously, I'm exaggerating, I think, for effect, but anything between, you know, every project depended on it to not a single project depended on it. But we just don't know because it was outside the scope of our analysis.
Thank you.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could put back up the economic impact summary slide. And then am I correct in understanding that the third column from the left, estimated proportion of projects that are BETC dependent,
mm-hmm.
is the conclusion to be drawn from the data reflected there that if we were to discontinue the program, 15, 10, 11, 15% there in the middle would be the only ones that would not have occurred?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bentz. Yes, in simple terms, that is correct. So our analysis, at the end of our financial analysis for the categories for which we felt we could do this, we tried to we did a somewhat simplified IRR analysis across all projects within the category to see how the whole distribution shifted, and what we were able to see was a percentage that moved from below the range to within the range. So it's a relatively simple approach in order for us to arrive at a number simply because we wanted to get a sense. I would not hang my hat on this specific number, which is why it's got the greater than symbol. It could be less than, but we think that we were trying to get an order of magnitude sense of how many were dependent, and so we think this is a good result. And yes, that would be the way you would interpret it, is that at least 15%, for example, of the lighting modifications would not happen if the people doing the projects went through the same thought process that we simulated in our analysis.
Follow-up. And then focusing again on the IRR, which appears to be the most important
yep.
element of the study, what we would be interested in, of course, is figuring out exactly how to find that and then applying it to those who might apply for whatever project.
Yeah.
So maybe you can share with us, I notice on the next page, your second bullet point, you talk about that in the middle there.
Yeah.
So how could we find that and then the DOE could apply it?
That is an excellent question. As I said, we were dependent on what we could find in reliable sources in the literature. The conservation category, I think, is particularly interesting here because, as was pointed out to us, we were using some sources that are focused more on the residential sector than the commercial sector, and we weren't looking at the residential sector at all. There, frankly, is not a lot of good literature on IRR expectations in the commercial sector for conservation, and that's partly a nature of those types of projects. IRR is not necessarily the determining factor for those projects. We used it because we wanted to be consistent across all the categories, but as you'll note, the ranges are fairly large and high. At the high end, we're getting some IRR numbers that make them look like very risky projects, when in fact they're probably some of the least risky projects. And a lot of that has to do simply with, we think, with information and the way people think about conservation. There's kind of consumer behavior issues, if you will, that where people don't think about a weatherization project in any way similar to the way they would think about putting building a wind project, for example, or even a solar. I do draw some comparisons between solar and conservation because the returns may not be great, but that may not be the reason why you do it. I think we mentioned at one point in the report, someone might have done a weatherization project because they needed new windows, not because they had done a calculation that said my IRR from energy savings because I put the new windows in is going to be X, Y, or Z. So there's a lot going on with these, and that's true probably of I'm giving a very long answer to a simple question, which is there is we believe these are good ranges, that they are we're in the right ballpark, but certainly to get a better sense, and perhaps through direct interviews. I mean, you can ask people. Every once in a while, a project file would actually say something about this and say, this is the return that we were shooting for. But I think, you know, I can count on one hand the number of times we actually saw that. But everybody has that. They have a number in mind. Whether they're willing to share it in every case, you know, remains to be seen.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Wand.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So we've seen the kind of the economic impacts, the but-for question for using the tax credits. Did you have any opportunity or was it within your scope of work to determine the economic impact of allowing the BETC to just completely expire and not be extended?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wand, no, we did not.
Follow-up? Was that outside the scope of your effort?
It was. Yes, we were simply focused on the economic impact of the projects within the universe that we had in front of us. You could derive, I suppose, at least an initial answer to that question by looking at the BETC dependence element and saying if the projects that were not BETC dependent, it's hard to say. I'm very hesitant to try to answer that question.
I assume, not being an economist, but I assume that there's a way that a person could sit down and look at the data and come up with an economic impact for not having a BETC at all. Is that a
sure.
fair characterization?
Mr. Chair, yes, Representative Wand, there's a way to do anything. But yes, we're consultants.
Economists
excellent.
And lawyers, they can figure out how to do things.
They just worry about the CPA. Thank you.
But yes, you know, and I would just follow up by saying these studies are all driven by the questions that you start out with. And so you develop your methodology to answer the specific question. And
thank you.
I have a couple questions. I just want to confirm that I heard correctly in your testimony and the answer you gave to Senator Morse. You essentially have two portions of your analysis, the IRR analysis, the financial analysis, and then the economic impact analysis. Was the data source the same for both the recreated pro formas out of the applicant files?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yes, initially, yes. The economic impact analysis followed from the financial analysis. So it was the same in the sense that when we decided, when we looked at a project and tried to estimate economic impacts, we did that based as much as we could on the same applicant file. We brought in additional information, again, from the literature just to get a sense of general relationships between, you know, projects and material costs and labor expectations. I mean, there's other information out there that I'm sure you're very well aware of that talks about, you know, what is the labor demand for building a project of type X. So yes, they are both rooted in the same applicant files, supplemented as necessary by other sources of information.
And how did you then ground truth, or were you able to ground truth the information you found in that applicant file? For example, on the financial side, as you're looking at that IRR calculation, mm-hmm. How does that relate then to, for example, limits that the OPUC might have on IRR for IOU-owned projects? On the economic impact side, were you able to tease out any of the data around sourcing of materials or sourcing of local labor or purchases to supplement the in-plan analysis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that's a good question, and we certainly did not do as much of that as we would have liked to have done or probably could have done. We made some efforts to contact. There was a process we went through to inform some of these applicants that we were looking at their project and we'd be interested in asking them some questions and getting some more detailed information. That effort did not get as far as we hoped it would, so we were not able to supplement it. That would have been our primary avenue, was to go directly to the projects and make sure that, and to ask them and say, this is, you know, these are the assumptions we're making. You may not be willing to share with us, you know, detailed information on your project, could you at least tell us, are we in the right ballpark? We wanted to know if we were making an assumption that was just completely divorced from reality. But we were not able to do that within the time and available to us. It is an interesting question. It's not that we're uncomfortable with the information we used, but it does leave open that question, certainly, whether there's something that we did not take into account that is critical. We're hopeful that that's not, and we don't think that that's the case. We would think it's more, you know, it would make changes around the margins more than it would fundamentally alter the analysis. But of course, until we had every last piece of information related to a project and how it fit within the world in which it was operating, we can't say that with 100% certainty.
And how does the value of the power sold relate back to both sides of the analysis? I could imagine on the financial side it might relate to that but-for question and mm-hmm. the IRR, and variations in the power may or may not change that IRR significantly.
Right.
And then on the economic side, the value of that power obviously accruing to the company or to the investment and then back into the economy. Did that go into either side of the analysis?
It did, right. And those numbers would have been shared across both. We collected as much information as we could to be as realistic as possible about that value of energy question, because it does drive a bit, you know, quite a bit of analysis. When you're talking about conservation projects that are saving energy, it translates into some money saved, and you decide, you know, where does that money go? And that decision on where it goes is what then gets fed into the economic impact model. So it did, and you'll see on the financial analysis side, it was obviously part of the IRR calculation, but also that sensitivity analysis that we tried to get a sense, knowing that we may not be hitting it right on the nose. We wanted to know, you know, does the result change significantly if you assume a higher or lower value of energy?
The committee will indulge a couple more questions from the chair. I'm curious to just ask a little bit about the models that you used. I noticed in your presentation that you used the JEDI model for large wind and plan for the others. Am I correct that JEDI is just a version of an input-output analysis?
Yes. JEDI, yeah. Yes, it is.
And in the inter-industry transaction matrix for JEDI, is the data source similar to implants?
It's actually the same. It ends up using implant multipliers. It's really more of a front end mm-hmm. that allows you to look a little bit more detail at wind energy projects, but it then just kind of dumps that information into what essentially is the same kind of implant, using the same implant multipliers.
And the implant model that you used, did that incorporate any sort of gravity model on local sourcing to bring in sort of regional multipliers? Or
that is a question that I have to defer to my colleague who actually ran the implant analysis. I do not know the exact answer to that question.
I'd be curious to know the answer on that.
Sure.
And also, if you could ask that, or maybe you know the answer, how the implant analysis spit out economic impact analysis numbers impact numbers without also spitting out jobs numbers. I noticed you, or maybe you have those, but it's not included in the report.
Yeah, I mean, kind of produces this employment demand in worker years, mm-hmm. so which is, you know, is not to say that it's creating a job. It may be demand for a job that already exists. I don't want to speak in too much detail about implant again because I didn't run the analysis personally, but we can certainly follow up on that question.
I'd be curious. Thank you. Colleagues, thank you very much, and thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. We will have, a week from today, a bill before the committee on the Business Energy Tax Credit where we can have public hearing on the concept, and so to be continued on this topic. Thank you. With that, do not listen. Well, I will close the informational meeting on the Business Energy Tax Credit Rate of Return Study and open a public hearing on House Bill 2524A, Senate Bill 822, and Senate Bill 903.
A recess and do the bill introduction while we're here.
I am going to pause, recess.
Yes, recess.
I'm going to recess that public hearing and open a work session on bill introduction. Committee, just a reminder that this is, bill introduction is a not a statement of support or opposition for any bill before the committee.
Mr. Chair, the committee has two LCs to be introduced as House bills, LC 4200 and LC 4201. You will notice a striking similarity in the two bills. They're actually really just to serve as vehicles for you to complete your business. 4200 is relating to tax credits, and 4201 is relating to tax expenditures.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Brett.
I move that we the committee introduce LC 4200, dated May 16, 2011, and LC 4201, dated May 16, 2011, as committee bills.
Co-chair Burdick moves that LC 4200, dated 5/16/2011, and LC 4201, dated 5/16/2011, be introduced as committee bills. Discussion. Objections. So ordered. We'll close the work session on possible bill introduction and reopen the public hearings on House Bill 2524, Senate Bill 822, and Senate Bill 903. And call for Dan Bates and Barry Woods and Jody Weiser.
Are those House bills or Senate bills?
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, could I inquire on the last action? Are these House bills or Senate bills?
House bills.
They're House bills. Thank you.
Go ahead and begin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Barry Woods. I am here on behalf of Drive Oregon. I'm a member of the board and a volunteer. I've got some written comments which are going to be disseminated, and so I'm going to let those speak for themselves, but I thought I would just take a moment to amplify a couple of areas that I think are strategic for your ongoing consideration with respect to the EV tax credits. First, there's a tremendous amount of information out there suggesting how important tax credits are for consumer adoption of electric vehicles. I can point to Oregon-based sources of that, including the Alternative Fuel Infrastructure Working Group. There's an Electrification Coalition, a detailed report that documents the importance of that incentive on consumer behavior. And there's also a university, an Indiana University report that I would commend to you to read as well, which talks about different state approaches to incentives and the impact of those. I can provide you with the citations for those should you so desire. The importance behind the credits in large ways relate to the need to level the playing field between electric vehicles and combustion engine vehicles. The primary expense associated in the manufacture of electric vehicles relates to the battery and the battery cost. And so I think in large measure the tax credits are designed to defray that and again to level the playing field and to make, more importantly, to make the vehicle affordable to a wider audience. So I neglected to talk a little bit about Drive Oregon just to, as part of the introduction, and I meant to do that. So before I proceed, Drive Oregon is a trade association of electric vehicle manufacturers that are primarily based here in Oregon, and their mission is to create a vital electric vehicle ecosystem. We have approximately 40 members and affiliates at the moment. They range in size from United Streetcar, Eaton, Ecotality, all the way down to Stites Design on the east side, who's involved in creating a human-powered electric trike truck. So That's a one-man shop. So a pretty wide range of manufacturers that are interested in this technology, not only designing vehicles, but also in the supply side, the supply chain, including wiring harnesses, the battery storage technology. And again, most of these are Oregon-based companies, and so we have obvious significant interest in generating consumer appeal for this technology. So I apologize for not providing that introduction when I first started talking. So besides the importance on the consumer side of incentivizing purchasing, I wanted to talk a little bit about how this tax credit may fit within the larger scheme that Oregon has devoted in developing electric vehicles and policy. I mean, as you are well familiar, I mean, there are many, many efforts being put forth by different agencies, including the Public Utilities Commission, which has an EV docket and a smart grid docket that relate to electric vehicles' impacts on utilities, the low carbon fuel standard, the minor label program to help streamline the certification of charging stations and residences, ODOT's Tiger and ERA grants that are designed to purchase infrastructure to assist in the creation of a green corridor going up to from Northern California going up to Vancouver, and Ecotality's EV project, which is focused on Oregon and is going to be providing between $16 and $20 million of infrastructure by its end in a couple of years. So tremendous amount of efforts are being put forth to generate infrastructure. One concern that we have is that unless we have the vehicles, all of these efforts are going to be for naught. And this is the preservation of these tax credits very specifically address something in the overall policy that I think is has not been emphasized enough, and that is the consumer need to look at these vehicles competitively with combustion engine vehicles, analyze the payback given the cost of gasoline, and come to some conclusion, you know, that it is worth taking a risk. And when you think about it, it's not that different from if you were to be buying a Honda Accord, and the dealer tells you, well, yeah, and you're also going to have to buy a gas pump for your residence. I mean, that the idea of an electric vehicle needing to have additional infrastructure associated in the residence and maybe costing an additional $2,000 is a novel idea. It has very significant economic ramifications, and the idea of having an incentive in place to help moderate the risk is a huge influence on consumer behavior. Couple other quick points. Ecotality, as an example, has looked at Oregon's market and chosen it out of the 50 states. Oregon is one of six states that currently has the EV project going on. And Oregon consistently, if you look at the research, figures very high relative to the 50 major metropolitan areas in terms of its demographics being conducive to an electric vehicle type culture. And so as we think about, you know, the future here and how we're going to contribute to that on the policy side, we ought to be thinking about the impact beyond just the boundaries of the state. I think we have a national audience, and I think it's something that we should not underestimate. One of my fears is that we don't do enough to keep the spark going, and that we lose this opportunity not just for Oregon economically to grow, but also for transportation electrification nationally to have a success story and to have the ability to learn what it takes to be successful. So as you think about the impact of the tax credit here in Oregon, think about the impact of the need for us to be successful on the national stage. And lastly, I want to just say a couple comments relating to the sunsetting of tax credits and the maturity of an industry. And I think one of the things that this industry is very concerned about is becoming autonomous and becoming freestanding. There's a lot of challenges facing it. As I said, I mean, we've got to develop the infrastructure. We have to develop the consumer mentality. But we do think we will get there eventually. We do think, however, that it's still in the early phases and that all of the assistance that we can get will help get us through that. We don't look at this as a perpetual tax credit. If you look at the other states that are out there, there's different triggers that will provide some protection for the early adoption period, whether it's the market penetration or whether it's a date certain. But we do look upon this as a real viable long-term venture, but we appreciate, you know, your consideration and assistance in getting it going and getting the infrastructure developed so that people will feel comfortable to purchase these vehicles. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Bates.
Chair Bailey, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address the committee on the tax credits real quickly. And Dan Bates representing Equitality and Revolt. Barry covered a lot of the Equitality. I'll start with Equitality, which will be rolling out the infrastructure that you'll likely see in the state of Oregon in the next 6 to 9 months. Their decision to invest in Oregon had everything to do with the ecosystem here. The tax credits are a part of that ecosystem and attracting, as this is a place of attraction of other businesses coming to locate electric vehicle operations as well as consumers to purchase. Barry went through the investment numbers of something in the range of $16 to $20 million over the next few years through the EV project. The second that I would mention is Revolt, which is a great success story for Oregon, in which, again, a number of incentives that the state used helped leverage their private investment to draw the international headquarters to Oregon. And in no small part, again, this is a place for electric vehicle introduction and adoption weighed heavily in their mind. The tax credits before you are a part of that ecosystem and a part of generating the interest both from the commercial side, the consumer side, and the manufacturing side. And both would urge your continued support of that ecosystem that these credits play a role in. Thank you.
Ms. Weiser.
Jody Weisen for Tax Fairness Oregon. Some of you have already heard me testify on this. And but just looking at our questions that, you know, well, how do we evaluate these tax credits and what should we do? We asked what's the public policy purpose of the credit, and these two gentlemen have both made clear that it's to try to get more people to buy electric vehicles. But is it actually necessary? Who directly benefits from the credit? Mostly high-income taxpayers and the businesses from whom they buy the cars. Is use of the tax credit an effective and efficient way to achieve the policy goal? And what's expected to happen if you just go ahead and let this not continue? Though there's nothing in the law that publicly states what the purpose is, it is to get people to buy the car. But there's zero proof that our appetite in Oregon for purchasing the Prius and then likewise the electric vehicle or any other hybrid vehicle wasn't because of the nature of the people who live in this state rather than the subsidies that were a primary motivating factor. The fact that Oregon has one of the highest renewable portfolio standards in the nation is a statement about who we are. The fact that we voluntarily purchase green energy at a higher price than regular energy is powerful evidence that being green is already an important value and a priority for citizens of our state. Portland General Electric has more renewable power customers than any other utility in the United States. Nissan chose to roll out in states based upon anticipated demand, not subsidy. More than 55% of all original Leaf reservations, those that were accepted in 2009 and 2010 via a refundable $99 fee, originated in just 5 states, and Oregon was one of those 5 states. The Ford Focus is due to be rolled out in 17 cities. Portland is one of them. The plug-in Toyota is set to roll out in 17 states, including Oregon. because 60% of Priuses were sold in these same states. Incenting the purchase of cars that the public is excited to purchase is actually government waste. In Oregon, the reservation list for the first round of the Nissan Leaf closed in September for cars that were expected to begin arriving in late December. In late November, early December, I don't remember when exactly, I tried to get on the list and found that I could get on the list to get on the list to give $99 down for a Prius, for a Nissan Leaf. And just on Friday, I got notification that I could now get on the list and put my $99 down.
Ms. Weiser, we have a copy of your written testimony. I want to make sure we have time for questions, so if you could summarize the remaining.
Okay.
That'd be great.
So Nissan expects that it's going to be high-income tax citizens who buy their cars. That's who bought the Priuses. We have that evidence in our tax expenditure report. So I don't think this is a necessary expense. Perhaps if we find in a few years that people aren't buying electric vehicles at the rate that we think they should be in order to roll out the industry and help, then we should consider stepping forward. But when people are waiting in line for cars, we don't need to incent their behavior at the cost of the other key services of our state. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Burr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just out of curiosity, Ms. Weiser, you always provide some intriguing thoughts and make me think second thoughts on things. How many members or who makes up your organization, just out of curiosity?
There are, we have email addresses for, there are over 2,000 people on our Facebook account. And we send e-blasts to 2,500 people. When we talk about renewable energy on our e-blast, on our Facebook accounts, we tend to lose some members because we lose some of the environmental community.
I might interrupt, actually. This might be a question for offline, given the amount of time we have left. Thank you. Other questions on these bills? Gentlemen, could you comment briefly on it? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
We have very limited dollars available for tax credits. I'm listening to what Jody has to say. Listen to what you have to say. One of the comments you made was it was like inviting people to build a gas pump at their homes. Would it make more sense to be working on the infrastructure to keep these things fueled than on supporting the purchase of the cars themselves, if given limited resources? Well, what are your thoughts?
Representative Barnett, we have a quandary I think the industry is in, and you know, you've heard the chicken and the egg analogy, and I think that is one of the concerns. Which comes first? Do we build the infrastructure and then expect the public to purchase the vehicles because of the convenience, the accessibility, more definite cost of operation? I'm not sure that I have not heard a specific answer to what is the correct strategy. And so that's why I think the parallel course makes sense. You know, for the average cost of a home charging station is about $2,000, and you're going in and you're buying a vehicle, you know, that you perceive to have some, you know, upfront costs that are fairly extreme. It makes the calculus more complicated.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Bailey, Representative Barnhart, if I can make clear that the credit does, in fact, do both now.
Yes, I understand.
Could you comment briefly, please, on the distinction between the two bills that we have before us, 2524, sure. And the other? And I think specifically within 2524 to that sunset provision linked to market share.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, the 2524 has a 5.5% trigger of new vehicles in which the sunset would happen earlier than 2018 if that market share for electric vehicles is hit. In the House Transportation Economic Development Committee, the industry was asked for a potential market indicator as to when the industry may be robust enough to not have that credit. That was what was one of the options that was put out there. Another option was a 1% of total vehicles registered that was considered. Given the overall numbers are in flux as to how many new vehicles are sold, we're now at a small number relative to where we have been historically. In 2009, there were 90,000 new vehicles in Oregon, which was frankly less than the industry had anticipated. So I believe 5.5% of that is around 5,000 new vehicles. Given where the industry is and early adoption, it's unclear and uneven as to how those vehicles flow. But that was an attempt at a trigger based on market indicators on cars. And A22 has no such indicator.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. And as I go through the stack of papers that I have in front of me, I also see Brian Krieg had signed up to testify. Brian, do you still want to testify? I apologize. I did not see you signed up earlier.
Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Burdick. For the record, my name is Brian Krieg. I'm here representing the Oregon State Association of Electrical Workers, IBEW. Just want to focus in the charging stations, putting them into the residences has been helpful in this down economy. It's helped keep some of our contractors going, keeping some of our folks employed. We have a high rate of unemployment at the moment, so there is a strong jobs element to this and helping to continue to move this forward so that electric vehicles become more of the standard in Oregon in the future would be a great thing. So we are very supportive of the tax credit component for the charging stations.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Krieg? Thank you. All right. Thank you, colleagues. With that, I will close the public hearings on House Bill 2524, Senate Bill 822, and Senate Bill 903, and close the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. The Joint Committee on Tax Credits.